Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. The war in Ukraine has reshaped Europe, and the ripple effects are still unfolding. With Russia on the offensive, the far right gaining ground, and Trump's return to the global stage, Europe faces urgent questions about its identity, unity, and future. Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, this episode explores the power struggles, political shifts, and global forces that are redefining Europe, and asks who will shape what comes next.
Thank you very much. My name is Christoph Blut. I'm Professor of International Relations and Security at the University of Bradford in the famous Department of Peace Studies and International Development.
Great. Thank you for being here.
And this is the kind of topic that I'm working on.
We've got a hungry demand for Europe, so we can kick off if you like.
I'll give you a few thoughts.
Yeah, please
do. And then we can have some discussion.
Sounds good.
So we've gone through a very peculiar kind of period. For the most time of my career as I work in nuclear weapons policy and international security. I've been working on the Korean Peninsula, but also on Europe. And I'm from Germany originally, so I have a particular interest in that, obviously. And also, I should say that my mother was from Ukraine, from Odessa, a Russian. The points that I want to very briefly make is that we've gone through a very peculiar kind of transition over the decades that I've experienced, which is that I grew up in the Cold War period. And the Cold War period was characterized by this enormous confrontation between two large military powers of different kind, obviously, the United States and NATO and the Soviet Union, which was pretty much dominated by the threat of nuclear war and very large-scale deployment of nuclear weapons. Just think about the fact that during the Cold War, the United States had deployed 7,500 short-range nuclear weapons in Europe, which is more than their total arsenal today, okay? But at the same time, even though the threat of nuclear war was always with us, at the same time, there was deterrence, which meant that there was no actual war in Europe, despite the fact that we had very large armies facing each other. Now, these armies disappeared, first of all, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of Soviet military power, Eastern Europe joining the European Union, ultimately. The Soviet military could collapse, the Russian military collapsed, and so this intense military threat disappeared. As a consequence of which, we have seen over decades now that European states have paid less attention to military preparedness. It's not that they haven't spent quite a lot. In fact, Europe as a whole spent a lot more than Russia over the decades on the military and has very advanced military equipment, fifth generation mostly. Russia's military equipment today is mostly old, although they have some very, very modern equipment as well, but most of their equipment is still quite old. But what has happened since then is that the efforts to integrate Russia into a common system of security in Europe in a peaceful way began to some extent successfully, but ultimately has failed. And the position that we're in now is that Russia is dominated by an elite and by a leader, Vladimir Putin, who is seeking to re-establish some kind of Russian empire. And the first step to doing this is to reassert control over what was known as the former Soviet space. And Ukraine is the most important part of this because the Russians don't really believe that Ukraine is a separate country. And that they were utterly astounded when Ukraine actually wanted to go independent as the Soviet Union dissolved. And they've never quite accepted the idea that they would lose over control over Ukraine. And when Zelensky was elected and Yanukovych had to leave the country, that is when Putin realized he was losing control over Ukraine and that Ukraine might actually become part of the West properly. Not necessarily militarily, because the efforts by Ukraine to join NATO were actually rebuffed to quite a large extent. So Ukraine was not on a very clear path to NATO membership per se, but it was on a clearer path to closer association with the European Union. And so step by step, it came to the point where then Russia invaded Ukraine. So what this means is that the global world order has changed, and we are still trying to understand exactly how it has changed. because on the one hand, we have a Russia which is now clearly hostile. It seeks Russia and China together, if you like, because China is, the balance of power has shifted, as we understand. Okay, it has shifted over a long period of time. We could see how it was happening. China was very much the junior partner to the Soviet Union during the Cold War period. But now China has become economically very powerful, and it's also increasing its military might. It hasn't yet reached the level of Russia. It's not yet a nuclear superpower, but it's on a trajectory that might take it there. And so what that means is that we have China and Russia who want to reconfigure the international system in some way. It's not entirely clear in what way this is going to happen. They don't want to abolish the international order completely, but they want to reduce the influence of the United States considerably. Now, on the other hand, as you know, in the United States, we have a leader who doesn't, at the moment at least, it may not last. Obviously, his term is limited. But at the moment, we have a president in the United States who, unlike the Europeans, and this is a very big division between the Europeans and the United States, doesn't really see Russia as an enemy necessarily, or doesn't see the international order being challenged in the way in which European leaders see it being challenged by Russia. It's my opinion that the European leaders have a better grasp of what Russia is, what Russia's intentions are. Okay. What is problematic for the Europeans is to find a proper means of addressing that. Now, one of the things that you may have observed has happened since then is that also the coherence of NATO has been undermined by the fact that the United States is creating a lot of ambiguity to the extent to which it's willing to protect the Europeans. Now, protection means that because the United States is the only nuclear superpower other than Russia, that means the United States provides what is called extended deterrence. It's sometimes called the nuclear umbrella. It means that the United States is willing to, it's not about using nuclear weapons per se, but it's about issuing the threat of using nuclear weapons in response to large-scale military aggression from somewhere else, in this case, Russia. Okay. Now, of course, NATO is not, European NATO is not without its means. European NATO has two nuclear powers, the United Kingdom and France. And so it can provide a level of deterrence itself, but not quite to the same extent. The interesting thing about this whole debate is that the current American military footprint in Europe is actually quite light, and it's reducing even further. During the Cold War, the United States had about 350,000 troops in Europe. It's now being reduced to 40,000. Okay. And so while Donald Trump moans about spending so much on the defense of Europe, the fact is the United States spends most of its money in other theaters. And Europe is actually quite low up down on the agenda. Of course, there's a potential that that might have to change. So we are in a kind of situation of uncertainty. The Europeans are trying to ensure that the United States remains committed to Europe, to NATO. And it also Europeans also want to make sure that the West remains cohesive, not only as a military alliance, of course, through NATO, but also as an economic and kind of norms-based alliance. In other words, we believe in the same things. We believe in liberal democracy. We don't believe in the use of military force for aggression and those kinds of norms that underpin our understanding of the Western system of norms. Go ahead. She was asking about the push from Macron and others. Yes. So the Europeans.
You want to rely less on the United States.
The Europeans have realized that they need to, that they are at a kind of cross point, that there is now uncertainty to the extent to which they can rely on the United States. And that means a clear decision that Europe has to play a much greater role. And Europe has to defend its interests not only against Russia, but to some extent, and that may be temporary, towards the United States. That's a new thing. That's a completely new thing, in a way. And what that means is, of course, Macron is even less important, I think, in some respects, than the German Chancellor, Merz, who has basically opened, just to give context, Germany has until now retained a very low debt level, okay, about 60% of GDP. And Britain and France can't could only dream of that.
Yeah.
But what that means is that Merz, as he's been now elected the new Chancellor of Germany, he has opened the coffers. He's basically, they're going to invest billions and billions and billions in defense, almost unlimited. Mm. And that means that within 10 years, Germany is going to be the most powerful military force in Europe, except that they won't have nuclear weapons. Mm. Okay.
And what about the fact, sorry, that the Ukraine war has dragged on this long? I mean, is that not an indication of the fact that Europe has failed to some extent to diplomatically or financially with sanctions or militarily to stop a war on its continent for this long?
It is true that the Europeans had such a strong belief that basically the idea of a large continental war in Europe was passé, was over.
Yeah.
That they didn't invest quite, they still did invest, to be sure. The European defense, total European defense expenditure of NATO countries was about $350 billion. Russia's for all these periods was only about $60 billion. So you ask yourself, why should we spend more money? It was not an unreasonable approach. I think they waited for too long because from 2008 onwards, the intentions of Putin and Russia became clearer and clearer and clearer. But nobody believed. I mean, I have studied Russia for many years and I've been involved in defense matters, and I was stunned by the fact that Russia started this war in Ukraine. Mm. I thought they would continue these low-level guerrilla-type activities and these so-called non-military gray zone warfare tactics. I didn't believe, and most people didn't believe, that there would be this major military assault on Ukraine. It was miscalculation on our part. It's also miscalculation on Russia's part, because Russia thought this war would be over in 3 days,
yeah,
and we are still here.
What about, I mean, you get people like the US Vice President J.D. Vance saying, you know, they're tired of bailing Europe out, and other commentators in the US saying Europe is dying. I mean, can it survive this period as a collection of states, as an idea, or is it, as some of the kind of far-right leaders are saying and far-left leaders are saying, that it's time to focus on the nation state rather than on this larger idea of Europe?
Well, focusing on the nation state is going to produce exactly what you just said, which is, well, of course, we do focus to a certain extent on the nation states, and that's fine. But Europe as a whole is still very powerful. I mean, and, you know, it has very advanced technologies. It has very advanced economies. China, European Union, and US are the three largest economies in the world, if you take them together. So Europe is very important, has a lot to offer. It has good defense industries. It buys a lot of equipment from the US, but it also produces, and it will produce more indigenous fifth or sixth generation. In fact, there is now a sixth generation fighter project that has been initiated, in which Britain is a part of. So Europe is not dead at all. Europe is alive, but there are challenges, obviously, that Europe has to meet. Now, the dilemma for Europe has always been with the Americans, and other allies know this also. If you are too independent, the Americans say, well, you don't need us, you can do it yourself. Okay? If you're too weak, then the American says, you're not doing your part. So this is the kind of tension that has existed ever since the end of the Second World War. The United States itself doesn't meet these targets at the moment, and it certainly doesn't contribute that much to the defense of Europe. But leaving that aside, Trump is one source of pressure. I think the main source of pressure is that there is a perception now that war with Russia in the future might be a reality. That hasn't existed before. Okay, we go back to 2000, even 2014, there was no idea that there was any likelihood we would get involved in a major war with Russia, potentially. And so the idea is how we can reestablish deterrence. And the main focus at the moment is to meet the deficiencies in the ammunition stockpiles, in the training of personnel, and the deployability of personnel. So one of the dilemmas I see coming in the future is if Germany really becomes... Germany at the moment is very weak militarily because of neglect. We all know this. But if Germany becomes the most powerful army in Europe again, people may be asking, and the Germans at it again? So that might raise doubts in the future. But don't mistake it. It's not just because of Trump. It's because of the way in which Russia has conducted itself and its ambitions that the Europeans are very, very serious about becoming a potent military power in collective, not individually. There's always a mistake to look at just one country. Collectively, NATO Europe will become capable of deterring Russia, I think.
We talked on about Trump and NATO. Perhaps we could talk a bit about the far right and how the growth of kind of nationalism is shaping the new world order in Europe.
Yes, so this is a very serious potential internal problem. Again, looking at Germany, the far right has become quite powerful. Fortunately, in the German system, in the British system, it's quite difficult for them to get control because of the electoral system. In the German system, it's also difficult because the parties can only govern with coalitions. And what has happened for now is that all of the other parties are determined not to work with the far right. The question is, how can we address some of the underlying grievances that fuel the far-right movements? And how can we achieve a level of social justice so that those who are not very well off will believe that they gain something from being part of a liberal democratic society? Mm-hmm. And that's really quite a challenging task. Yeah.
It's a huge project, isn't it? Okay, I think we're ready to take some questions. What do you think? You ready?
I'm ready.
Yes. Where shall we go?
Hello? Hello. You can hear me good. I've got two questions, actually. I don't know if I can ask two questions, but the first one is, do we really still believe that Europe is a liberal democracy? That's the first one. And second one is, why would Putin want to invade Europe or to become a military power in Europe when he's got so much already on his hands with Ukraine? I mean, if you go on social media, I know we're all, you know, dubious about social media, but Putin is off and on speaking directly to the Russian people and to actually lots of people around the world. And he says he has no intention of doing that. And there is no reason. He has all the resources he has, you know, and so on. So my question is really, why would he involve himself in such a huge thing to invade Europe or to be a force against Europe when actually what resources would he need from Europe? What would be the point of that?
Okay, I'll start for the first question, which is a very big question. Yes, I believe the European states, including the Central European states of the former Warsaw Pact and Western Europe, are largely liberal democracies. We have some issues in Hungary, for example, that we're all aware of. And we have other tendencies in Poland, and Poland is still a very loyal member of the European Union. Yeah, we have issues in some of the countries. And we have issues about accountability through the European Union, okay? So these are very complex issues, but nevertheless, first of all, I strongly believe in liberal democracy, and I do believe that liberal democracy is still alive and well in European countries. As for the ambitions by Putin, we have some clear insights about his imperial ambitions to reestablish Russia as a great power. And the first step to that is linked with the countries that used to belong to the Soviet Union. And that some of them are in Europe, in the European Union. So at the margins, I don't believe that Putin will invade Britain. I think that's implausible for many different reasons. One, geography. Two, Britain is a very powerful country and Britain is a nuclear-armed country. So I think that's completely implausible, but that there could be military operations at the margins that he might want to destabilize the Baltic countries and the countries from the former Yugoslavia, the Balkan countries. That's already in progress, in fact. There is destabilization already going on. And that so that the sphere of influence of Russia, it's trying to establish what's called a sphere of influence. Now, that's an old sort of international relations concept. I believe nowadays we don't believe in spheres of influence that are created with the use of coercion or military force. In other words, for countries to join together, to work together, to cooperate together, diplomatic influence, all of that is not problematic. What is problematic is to use, which is Russia seemingly have to use, military force or other forms of violent coercion to create this kind of sphere of influence. It's also on a hiding to nowhere. What will happen if Russia actually occupies Ukraine? They will be in a kind of civil war still for decades to come after that. So I don't believe it's possible for Russia to occupy Ukraine. But the way in which the Russians are thinking clearly is that they are trying to expand their sphere of influence. It doesn't mean they're going to invade the whole of Europe, no. And I think there are other factors that make this direct large-scale military assault somewhat implausible. Because, again, as I said, even European NATO has two nuclear powers. Okay. Fighting Europe is not the same thing as fighting Ukraine. I mean, the Europeans do have very, very advanced weapons. They have fighter aircraft. They have the most advanced fighter aircraft that Ukraine doesn't have. Okay. They also have more air defense systems and so forth. There are deficiencies, clearly. We are aware of this. But that would be a completely different thing. So I think perhaps some of the pronouncements you hear from political leaders at the moment are a little bit exaggerated. I think the purpose of these pronouncements is to motivate countries to build up a more sustained conventional deterrence force. And that in itself might be important because deterrence is designed not to fight a war, but to prevent a war. But I think I agree with you that we have to keep the risks and threats in proper perspective. You know.
Thank you. We've spoken a lot about military power or hard power, but I feel the bigger issue is soft power. And you mentioned China a couple of times. So I'm sure, as you'll be aware, China is increasing its influence through universities in the UK and the US, through funding Oxford, Edinburgh universities, through setting up cultural centres, I think they call them. Obviously, you can argue there's some surveillance going on as well. But also China has become the manufacturing superpower of the world. Most of our goods are there. They are a technology superpower. They no longer just copy technology. So DeepSeek, the AI that China produced, was produced at like 5% the cost of our Western AI models. And they did that, with significant restraints. And at the same time, Chinese influence is coming in as a technology superpower, as a manufacturing superpower. I think it's an influential superpower. And they're doing it, I think, in a very clever way, through funding, through grants, through getting senior officials onto UK institutions and boards. So my question is two-part. A, do you agree with that, that there is an influx of soft power from China? And if you agree with that, how do you see Europe changing over the next 10 years, as that, I think, will only increase?
Yes, I mean, I should start off by saying that my wife and daughter are from China. So I have a good knowledge of China, but I agree with the things that you've said, actually, which is that China is trying to change the international order in these kinds of ways. That's for sure. And this is a very difficult question. I don't think we can or should completely disengage from China. I don't think that's workable. I don't think it's desirable. And we also have soft power. I mean, I know a lot of people in the Chinese community here, and a lot of them are very westernized and have adopted Western values. And so we can have an influence as well. But we need to be careful. I mean, we need to be careful about illicit methods used by Chinese authorities to put surveillance on their citizens in this country or other Western countries. And in terms of technological cooperation, again, there are various issues such as making sure that they don't steal our technology, which they've done in the past, and maintain. We cannot disengage completely, as I say, but we disengage on some levels. So some levels, for example, high-end AI and computer technology that's being used for military purposes, we put limits on what can be exported to China and so forth. And we need to keep a very close eye on the machinations of Chinese authorities in these countries with these cultural centers and with these so-called Chinese police stations that apparently seem to exist here to surveil Chinese people in Western countries. So I think this is a very, very tricky approach. And governments need to formulate clear strategies to deal with these various things, also cyber attacks and so forth. These are very, very complicated issues. There are also military issues involved, because as you know, China is putting military pressures in these so-called territorial disputes in the South China Sea, and the United States Navy is patrolling the area, but there is a question whether enough is being done. We have the AUKUS now with the purpose of providing deterrence against an attack on Taiwan. Taiwan is going to be a very problematic issue because the pressure from China is increasing on Taiwan. And there's also pressure on Korea, which is very Korea won't talk much about China because they don't want to be seen as being an American stooge attacking China, but they're fully aware that China is a serious security problem for them as well. And so it's a mix of kind of strategies. We can do political engagement, we can do economic engagement, we can draw the line on various things. I mean, for example, I don't know what you think of Boris Johnson, but his effort to limit the involvement of Huawei in the development of 5G technology in the United Kingdom was probably a very wise step. And so it is important to have friendly relations with China, but also draw very clear limits. Yeah.
Hi. My question predominantly is a part of Europe itself. Of course, you know, you looked at countries like, you know, Britain, you talked about Germany itself, but I'm more talking about smaller countries. You know, we're living in a multipolar, you know, like region that is pretty much getting more fragmented as we talk right now. And my question asks is in the terms of how do small countries in Europe, in an ever-shifting world of global politics, hold up in the security, in the, you know, sovereignty, and also the sides that they're going to take as well. Now we have, you know, you talked about China itself, we've talked about China. You know, when I went to Beijing, you know, the predominance of Europe was pushing into Beijing as well. So it's working both ways. But also these small countries are now looking at these big national players, worldwide players. How will these countries hold up in the next few decades to come?
Yes, so I don't really see any much difference between a choice other than to create alliances. The interesting thing, I think, is that in Europe, the smaller countries are actually doing quite well. I mean, we see the Baltic states and Poland, maybe Poland isn't one of the smaller countries, but the Baltic states doing enormous and amazing work in terms of rebuffing Russian efforts of influence, building up their military forces, maintaining their relations with the European Union and NATO. If you look at other parts of the world, if you look at the Far East, obviously what you have is a kind of, some people have described it as a kind of bipolar situation between the United States and China. A lot of these countries don't want to be just beholden to China, but they desperately need Chinese money. At the same time, they are open to arrangements with the United States, but they don't want to formally enter into an alliance with the United States. And so for now, at least, that is kind of a system that seems to be working for some of these countries. And we can see Vietnam, for example. Vietnam is China's neighbor. It clearly feels under threat. I remember one time, this is about maybe 10 years ago, I was in Vietnam giving a lecture on the Far East security, and I talked about what at that time was the Chinese doctrine, the peaceful rise of China. And everybody in the audience laughed when I said that. And that to me was a clear indication of how the Vietnamese feel about China. But at the same time, they have to have a good relationship with China. But they also are building a strong relationship with the United States. So they're kind of trying to balance their position as best as they can. And I think for some countries, this is appropriate. But where we can form coherent alliances, that's also appropriate. And so the fact that Australia, Britain, and the United States are now putting this emphasis on providing deterrence in the Far East for certain kinds of threats could be seen as quite a positive step. But it will also involve Japan and Korea. During the Biden administration, Japan and Korea and the United States started to form a very strong tripartite alliance, almost on the same level as NATO. The extent to which this can continue now with Trump, we're not quite sure. The United States allegedly is putting more emphasis now on the Far East rather than Europe. So let's see whether they're going to put their money where their mouth is on this one.
Yeah. I think most US administrations have made a similar pivot, haven't they, in the last few decades? Oh, sorry. You can.
We've been speaking a lot about war, and as far as I'm aware, there's no carbon neutral bombs. War is extremely bad for the climate. And especially as we're talking about the future of Europe, we're going to be extremely impacted by the climate crisis, of which we're one of the biggest contributors to. Yet so many other continents and economies will face much severe impacts much sooner. How do we navigate that whilst also trying to encourage development?
I don't have any answers, but what I just would say is, generally speaking, I mean, I'm a strong somebody who's at one point in my life studied physics. I'm a strong believer in climate science, and the some of the predictions that I made seem very plausible to me, and therefore I would continue to support any actions that are taken to reduce carbon output or to become carbon neutral. Mm. But I wouldn't want to comment further on that because it's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
I suppose it could also be a security issue, climate too.
Absolutely, it is already. Yeah, it is already, absolutely, and especially of course in some parts of Africa.
For example, the migration. Yeah.
I mean, on that same similar theme, how much do you think the strategic views on a new world order take into account the impact of climate change, apart from the US expressing an interest in Greenland and potential interests in the Arctic, as the ice melts? How much does that need to be factored into our understanding of alliances, of alignments of powers in the coming decades?
So we have a very difficult situation at the moment because the current US administration is and to some extent Congress actually is dominated by people who don't believe that we should take any action against climate change at all, but that we should pump as much oil and gas as possible.
I think the phrase was drill, baby, drill.
Exactly, yeah. And this is part of the general thing. I mean, if we talk about the New World Order, we're kind of at an edge because we don't know whether the United States is going to be our partner in future or not. Now, John Bolton, who was always hated by liberals through his entire career, now has issued a plea in a British magazine trying to tell us, don't assume that you should do everything yourself and that you wouldn't have a relationship with the United States because of Trump, because Trump only has 4 years in office. And maybe that's true. We don't quite know what the political configuration is going to be like in the US in the future. And there are other partners that are important. China is important, and China invests a lot in renewables. It's also still putting a lot of carbon dioxide because it's ravenous in its energy consumption. So what I think is most important, if we can keep the global schemes that are designed to globally reduce carbon output going, if it's at the moment US is not part of the Paris Accords, we have to work towards a way of either finding an alternative or to find them to re-enter at some point in the future. I wish I had a clear answer for how to proceed with this question, but I think the policies the European states are pursuing are generally quite positive, and there's still quite a strong commitment, and even in this country, although if you read conservative newspapers, you might find a lot of derision about net zero and so forth. Anytime I analyze those articles in detail, their arguments don't hold up, really. So give Miliband a chance.
I was just going to add as well, I guess sometimes climate change will find you anyway. So in the United States, they're constantly having to deal with, you know, floods and hurricanes. And right now, the Texas floods. And I wonder if it will end up being that people look after their own neighborhood. So we saw the floods in Spain last year. And I wonder if it's just that the countries will look out for each other rather than this huge international approach. But I'm not an expert. I'm just positive.
The problem is obviously that whatever one country does can be negated what another country does.
Yeah.
I mean, environmental action is really something that requires global leadership.
Yeah.
And we don't have this at the moment quite the way we had it in the past, but that doesn't mean it can't be reconstituted.
Yeah, and I would also advocate for local action as well as global leadership.
Sure.
Yeah.
My question, thinking about the New World Order, is how do you think what's going on in the Middle East fits into the changing New World Order? I mean, not just the Israel-Palestine issue, but, you know, Iran, but also different situation in Syria now to how it was, the whole collection and the change in power that's going on there in terms of how that fits into the New World Order and perhaps stretching it a bit, the future of Europe.
Yeah, so this is a very, very difficult and complex issue because we have many various geopolitical actors in the Middle East, and there have been very deep enmities and conflicts in the Middle East for centuries, basically. But what has happened now, obviously, is that, well, Israel has, well, if you want to put it this way, Israel has been sort of accepted as a liberal democracy in the Middle East, in fact, the only liberal democracy in the Middle East. Some of the actions that have taken place with respect to Gaza, and I'm the first one, I actually visited Israel a few months before this event happened. And I have to say that it was a wonderful visit. And I have a very close colleague who is an Arab Israeli, and who is very conscious about the issues of the Arab population inside Israel. The way in which in Netanyahu has responded to it, and if we look at the policies, of course, that preceded all of this, raises a great deal of issues about why the ethics, if you like, of this kind of conflict. And we are very unclear what the plan is for the future for Israelis and Palestinians to live peacefully together. And at the same time, we've had this conflict with Iran. Now, Iran has always seen itself as a separate kind of center of power in the Middle East. But it's been in conflict, of course, with the Sunni Arab states as well. And so what we really want to see in the Middle East is that there is some kind of settlement between the Sunni Arabs and the Iranians, and that the Iranians had been seeking to undermine other states, Syria and Lebanon in particular. So there is at the moment no leadership really that is designed to bring a proper settlement in the Middle East forward. The attack on the, if you want me to talk briefly, talk about the attack on the nuclear.
I was just going to say that, in keeping with what you were talking about earlier, it seems like Europe is increasingly defined by how it reacts to other countries. So China, US, you know, the Middle East, the impact that it has on it. I mean, is that fair? I mean, for example, the last time the Middle East was a big issue to Europeans, it was the Syrian conflict and the migration of people across the Mediterranean Sea. So it seems like Europe's, the way you've painted it, could arguably be quite passive in response to the Middle East or the rest of the world. Is it time for the Middle East, for Europe to have its own voice on such big issues? Or do you think it will continue to side with America or China or Russia?
There have been times when the Europeans have been very active. I mean, the JCPOA, which Donald Trump abandoned and which led to this whole crisis, the JCPOA was the agreement, nuclear agreement, which was concluded with Iran, where Iran eliminated almost all of its fissile materials and some of its illicit, so-called illicit activities beforehand, in return for getting some of the money that had been frozen since the Iranian Revolution in the United States banks. That was concluded primarily by the Europeans. There was enormous European leadership in bringing this about. And so the Europeans are still very strongly committed to the principle of nuclear non-proliferation, that in other words, there should be no more nuclear states. And in fact, all countries that don't have nuclear weapons have signed on to the non-proliferation treaty. So that's a huge success so far. That's being undermined. I mean, if you think about it, you know, if you look at Ukraine and Iran, what is the consequence of thinking about the actions by Israel, America, and the United States? We have to have nuclear weapons. This would never happen if we had nuclear weapons. So it seems to encourage nuclear development rather than stop it. Mm. I personally do not believe that and we can only go on the limited information that we have, obviously, that this attack on the facilities in Iran has permanently destroyed Iran's nuclear ambitions. I also don't believe that Iran was in the process of building a nuclear weapon. I think what they were doing was they were using enrichment as a way of getting leverage over the United States, and that backfired very badly, as we can see. This strategy didn't work. Whether there is now a decision taking place in Iran to ultimately build a nuclear weapon, I'm not sure. Nobody knows. But one has to see at the context and the possible consequences of action, and not just saying, okay, we hit these facilities, we destroy these facilities, so the problem is solved. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I think China certainly, in its immediate geographical area, it wants to reduce the military influence of the United States. It wants to regain Taiwan. It wants to get control over this area of the South China Sea, which it claims is its own. So these are some very immediate goals. In larger terms, I think it wants to kind of rebalance the international system so that the United States and Europe are less powerful, and that China has more political influence. But it's not the same thing as controlling other countries. I think it wants to tone down some of the norms in the international system that are currently being used, if you like, against China. So it's kind of a rebalancing of power, the creation of a multipolar system. It was this was already mentioned. I don't think it's a very good term, because polarity implies having power over other states. But to have coercive power over other states is something that we don't accept and that we reject. So we shouldn't aim towards polarity. But that's the Chinese and the Russians constantly talk about multipolarity because they want to reduce the influence of the United States.
Okay, last question.
Sorry, I can't hear.
How do you see the Russia-Ukraine war concluding?
Well, this is very difficult to say. There is a possible scenario in which Ukraine, at least as a de facto situation, accepts that Luhansk and some the Donbas area and some of these areas in Crimea remain under Russian control, and that there is a ceasefire and that there's no further conflict. Okay, and that maybe Ukraine will have to stay out of NATO. Those are the kinds of terms that are being discussed. It's not clear that Russia is willing to accept it yet. There is a possibility that Russia could, that the Ukrainian defense would collapse. I don't think that's imminent, and that Russia would actually occupy Ukraine, and that would create a lot of anxiety in Europe. But it would also remain a continuing headache for Russia. And there are other possible scenarios. We know that the Russian economy is under very severe strain. Many people are surprised that it has lasted as long as it has. But we see a lot of hesitation in the United States to keep up the supply of armaments to Ukraine. And so that puts Ukraine into a very precarious position.
Okay, I think we'll end there. But thank you very much. And I apologize again that Professor Owen Green wasn't able to make the lecture. And thank you very much, Christoph Berth, for stepping in.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.